You're listening to Speak Loud, resilient stories of triumph and hope, helping you to turn your past into fuel for your best future. Here's your host, founder of the 501c3 Share, providing resource and support for trauma victims, and a survivor herself, Tiffany Barnes.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Speak Loud podcast. As always, I am your host, Tiffany Barnes, and thank you so much for tuning in with me today. So last episode was a solo episode. I talked about my trip to Hawaii and some of the issues that I'm still dealing with my dad. And today I have a guest in house with me. Well, not in house. She's actually from a land far and wide. Alaska, the only state in the United States I haven't been to yet. I gotta go. We talked about it a little bit before we hit the record button. She saw some bears in the city. Like, I just can't even imagine. But so she comes from Alaska. That's where she's from on the Zoom today. Her name is Lisbeth Meredith, and she has a lot going for her here. She is an author. She wrote a memoir called Pieces of Me, Rescuing My Kidnapped Daughters. And this book has won 5 awards and might possibly turn into a TV. I don't know if it's episodes or series. We'll have to ask her about that. She's also a speaker and an online teacher. She's a former child abuse investigator, which really intrigues me. I can't wait to pick her brain on that one. And she's a now retired juvenile probation supervisor. So without further ado, please welcome the lovely Lisbeth Meredith.
Thank you for that beautiful introduction, Tiffany. And I am so excited to be here today. I've listened to the podcast. I'm just honored to be asked. And this is terrific. Thank you.
Yes, thank you for being here. I mean, it's earlier there. We won't say how early, but you got up early to hang out with me and to share your expertise, which I can't wait to hear more about. But before we get into kind of what you're doing now to help in the abuse category, I would like to, again, on a very surface level, because we don't want to trigger anybody, but we want to have the audience identify with some of your story. Take us back on your journey of abuse. You know, was it something that you dealt with as a child? Is it something you dealt with later in life? Kind of take us down that road a little bit.
Absolutely. And I love that you're cautious about not triggering people. I am the same way. And I want people to know that I'm a very happy, most of the time, older than middle-aged woman living in Alaska. So everything's just, you know, imperfect, but fine. And, but when I was young, when I was a little kid, I grew up in a really volatile, I would say, household. It wasn't always, and I think that's always the mind mess that happens to children when they're growing up. You know, there were good times, and then there were lots of other times. And so when I was very little, what I remember thinking as I was, you know, getting old enough to formulate thoughts like this was, wow, this is a lot of chaos. I am going to do differently when I grow up. There was sometimes violence in the home, family violence. There was parental alienation. There was a ton of control. And I just remember thinking, oh my gosh, I'm going to have kids of my own one day. That was always in my brain, was I just wanted to be a mom. And I, just because I think I'm going to do better, I'm going to do better. And then fast forward many years, not even that many years, really, in my 20s, I was in a foreign country looking for my kidnapped daughters because I had not done any of the work that's necessary to really make the changes that a person needs when they're abused. And so I hadn't kind of given myself a chance to heal, given myself a chance to get some support, to know better, to do better. And so I went from a very controlling, abusive environment to grabbing onto the first hand that seemed very similar to my childhood that I could find, and got married and had a couple of kids. So it, you know, really my story is kind of a cautionary tale. I know that there are people who feel like, well, I'm going to do better. And I did. Just look at me, look at my marriage. For me personally, I think that what would have helped is, you know, to give myself a chance to heal and to know more and to maybe do some therapy, maybe read some books, you know, maybe not be so anxious to get into a relationship. But I wanted to, I was from a really controlling environment and I looked for someone to save me. And oops, that was not what happened.
Right. So if you don't mind, I have a couple questions based off of what you were talking about, your, you know, your upbringing. So your parents were very controlling in the sense like they controlled who you even had in your sphere, right?
Well, here's the interesting thing. My mom was married some, you know, I would say she was married a couple of few times and she married my dad twice. I didn't even know my dad, didn't meet him till I was 20 and looked him up with a lawyer. But what I found out, and she had a sort of a replacement dad that has since passed away, but who illegally adopted me. We didn't know that my dad actually didn't want me to be taken away. So there was parental kidnapping in our family where two sets of kids from different fathers, only the girls. My mom was not crazy about boys. She had boys and left them behind. But she took some of her kids and without any warning to the fathers, disappeared. And took her final marital partner, as near as I can tell, that was her final one, and came to Alaska from the South. So I'm from Kentucky originally. She was from Louisiana, and her final husband was from Louisiana. And we came up to Alaska. A lot of people who ended up in Alaska back in the day, it's a wonderful place to go. Just one of the listeners to know this, but a lot of people got up here. Either they were in pursuit of money because of the oil opportunities, or frankly, they were running from something. And that was our situation. She was running from something and frankly had done some things that could have gotten her into a lot of trouble. So here we were as little transplants. And the family dynamic was such, there were great times at times, but she had a lot of control, a lot of physical abuse if you didn't follow her exact directions. But for the rest of us kids, I think one of the most damaging parts was we were forced to shun whoever it was that she was angry with.
Wow.
And so if we were at the dinner table and she was mad at one of the kids, she would literally say, you know, she wouldn't look at the kid, wouldn't acknowledge them, which is sad, but it would go on for long, long periods of time. So she would tell the rest of us, like, well, tell her highness over there, she should pass the butter or pass the salt and pepper or whatever. But then we wouldn't even look at that person because we did not want to be the next target. And so we literally have a sibling who that isolation, and she was, you know, I had two sisters who really, really, really were the target much more than me. But it did not fare well for things like mental and physical health.
Wow. I can't even imagine. So you mentioned you were the youngest of the children, right?
Of her kids. Yes. Her dad, it turned out when I met him, he had a whole bunch more kids. So yes, but of the kids, the cohort that I grew up with, the Petri dish, it did feel like it was a horrible experiment, but where I grew up, yes, I was the youngest of her children.
So if she was angry at one of the kids, you all had to be angry at that kid too. Or like you say, they would be isolated to the point like you don't want to look at them. You don't want to act like you're being nice to them at all, because then you would have to face repercussions of punishment.
Right. Exactly. So we weren't, you know, the kids, they're wonderful siblings, but there were times when we did not advocate for one another. It wasn't always like that. And like I said, in our household, we had plenty of other times besides abuse. But we weren't able to advocate for them or able to really give them support in those awful moments like you would want to have happen, because next it would be us. And what would happen is then a child would, if the child went too far out of whack, in my mom's eyes, they would just disappear. And so whether they're thrown out of the house, sent away somewhere, they would just be gone. And so it wasn't really a secure, great environment. And yet I had the guilt growing up of, you know, especially when I was the youngest, at times she'd really favor me. And my mom could be so charming and so fun. And so I had this sort of guilt of like, wow, you know, I wish they could experience this side of her, because she can be so funny and amazing. And she just adored me at times. And that's old, a whole other mess on the mind, you know, because I felt really guilty about that. And there were periods where I was super loyal and fell into line with her, but I had to stop. And so when it came time to marrying someone, which I thought was definitely in my script, I really did reach for the first hand that seemed to have all the answers and, you know, would kind of rescue me. And that's not a good space to be in.
Right. But again, it came, you were a product of your environment, but the fact that you, and I want to get into these, this later life, but I want to mention one other thing because it's so intriguing to me. The fact that she didn't like boys, meaning like when she'd birth a boy, she's like, nope, next, you know, unless you were a girl, it felt like, then she's like, okay, I want to keep this one. So and she'd ship the boys out. That's interesting.
It is interesting, and I'm not sure, you know, I have always suspected that there was mental health problems definitely rooted in some trauma of her own that she was very proud not to address. I mean, my mom was very much against getting help or counseling or whatever. You needed to pray away any of that stuff. Mm. And so, you know, I feel very badly because the boys were left behind when she had been given custody, and really she should not have been, this wouldn't happen today, but she was given custody of her children. And then when it came time to leaving with her final partner, she didn't even look back. Like the boys didn't get called on holidays. They didn't get, you know, they didn't get any relationship with their mom. They certainly didn't get child support. It was, they came home, and I found this out by my adult brother later. I met him in my 40s. Wow. I met my final brother at a book event in Kentucky. There was a brother I'd still yet to meet. And I was like, I'm going to say 53 when I finally met him. I'm lucky they're not dead because we are older people now. But she never looked back. And that was the end of that. And when the kids came, when the boys came home from, you know, where they thought they were their sisters, they were told, don't talk about it. You know, their dad was so traumatized, but he was like, they're gone and don't talk about it at all.
Wow.
And so in my generation, we are older. You know, I'm in my 50s. They're a little bit even older than that. We were not really encouraged to spill family secrets. And I know there are still a lot of families like that, but that really turns in on us. That trauma, these are things that there's nothing people can't overcome with the right help and unpacking it and all of that. But if you don't, it's amazing that we can carry it for a lifetime inside us, the shame, the guilt, and then it turns into other problems.
Wow. And like you say, so fortunate that you were able to reunite with your brothers at a later time. So when you, so you've now met all of them that you know of, right?
Yes.
And so how is that dynamic? You know, was it like so elated, like, oh my gosh, I've always wanted to know you? Or some people are like, I didn't even know you were out there. Like, how did it go?
Well, we were lucky in that we knew each other were out there by that point. So that was a very wonderful thing. So when I met the first brother, I had reached out to him when my kids were kidnapped. That's another story. But I had reached out because I heard he was in law enforcement. By this point, I was in my later 20s. He lived in another state. And, you know, we at least emailed, but we didn't have a, you know, we were strangers, but he was glad that somebody, he had lost his little sister when he was young. It was a young boy. His mother rejected him. He was told not to talk about it. And he lost his sisters that he was so close to, including me, who was a toddler. And so for him and for me, that was really special to reconnect, really special. And so eventually we met many years later in my 40s, and it was pretty dynamic. It was, you know, the other brother had a lot of bigger problems as he got older. Some of it spiraled so out of control. So he really, really, really struggled to just like live alone, take care of himself, to be able to talk. So I had tried to reach out to him before with no luck, but a sibling gave him in the lower 48, gave him one of my books. He read it and then decided to come to a book event that was actually pretty crowded. And it was so incredibly touching. I've never heard back again, and I don't expect to because his health has taken a turn, but that was absolutely beautiful.
Wow, that's something for the movies right there.
That was beautiful.
Yeah,
that was.
How incredible. So into your so when did you get married? How old were you when you got married?
I was 20. I just turned 21 and very inexperienced in that way. And 21-year-old, not real worldly when it came to dating or all the things.
Yeah, and so you said you kind of took for that firsthand, right?
Yes.
You're like, okay, I've got someone who likes me. I'm ready to go for it.
You know, I did really poorly in college. I'm going to tell you, I gave it a whirl at first, you know, but I just couldn't do it. You know, I had such troubles when I was young and I went away to college and I was so happy being away from my mom. But when I eventually accepted the fact that I had kind of failed out of college the first time around, there was other chances and I finished. And I met him. I should have known there was a problem when my mother said, I really like him.
Oh,
oh, come on now. That should have been like, I should have stopped, dropped and rolled. So,
oh man,
I was like, that's great, because pleasing her still was a big, big deal for me. And he felt so familiar. And that did not turn out so well.
So I'm supposing it ended in a divorce then.
It did, 4 years after, and they were bad. I mean, you know, I think, and I joke because frankly, there's nothing to do but laugh at this point, but I married and I just tried to please him, you know, and I didn't know how to do anything that a wife would normally do in my mind. You know, I couldn't cook, couldn't do laundry well that he liked, in a way that he liked it. There was nothing I did right. And so at first he would kind of pick away at those things, and I was working, but he wasn't wrong. It wasn't like anyone enjoys raw chicken for dinner. I mean, I get it, you know. No, I mean, he kind of had a point, but there was just nothing I could do. And when I got better at certain things, like cooking the chicken, let's say all the way, where you wouldn't get some sort of awful poisoning, there was always something more, something worse. And so, and I think a lot of times what we don't understand when we're getting into a relationship is if someone loves you so much right away, but they actually don't even know you, right? I mean, they don't know us. And then next thing you know, we go from being held up on a pedestal to every single thing is wrong. And then he would say things like, and again, they weren't all untrue, your family's insane. If I wasn't here for you right now, nobody would be in my place. You'd be all alone. You understand, nobody wants to be with you. And I don't think that I felt at the time that he was wrong. And I did feel unlovable. I did feel very fortunate he wanted to be with me. And I then got more cut off from my friendships. That person isn't good for you, he'd say. That's a negative influence. Or I would be so embarrassed with the life that I was living that I wouldn't reach out to them any longer because I was just embarrassed with how bad I felt. And so it started out that way, where it was like, wow, I didn't even recognize myself a year later in the marriage. I was so cut off and sad and insecure and isolated. And, you know, it wasn't physically abusive at all at first. But when I had a child, my first child, at 22, it felt like I gained some power. Suddenly the world had meaning and I had a mission and a purpose. And a lot of times abuse escalates during pregnancy. And I think it comes from that sense of agency, that feeling of I am doing something so amazing. I am about to incubate the world's most meteoric person in the entire world. Like, this child is going to be dynamite. And the attention goes away from the person who you were in a relationship with and on to something different. And so abuse really can escalate. And for us, it got pretty ugly. And I had my first child. But do you know, Tiffany, what I thought as a young person was, well, I've made my bed. I'll live in it. I will forgive and forget. My kids are not going to grow up in what I called then, and it's ridiculous when I think about it, but a broken home. They're not going to have a broken home. They're going to have parents that don't divorce. I think what I didn't realize as a young person was that does not determine brokenness at all. And it's really unhealthy for kids to grow up with that volatility. Even for babies, they're sensing the stress in their environment. And I was so delighted with her, and I felt like, you know what? this is so great. I'll have another, please, because it's the only thing I have going, you know? And again, I look back on that and I have a lot of guilt because that's not how, why you have a child. Child is not something to make you feel better. It's not to get over with in your youth. So you are a young mom or something like that. It's, you know, I mean, it was just a mess that I brought them into. He was from another country. He would occasionally say, if you ever left me, you'll never see those kids again. I will disappear so fast, you'll make your head spin. You will never see me again. And while it haunted me, what I realized truly was he never wanted to do stuff with them. He had his own out of control issues. So, you know, I know he loved them. I don't mean that he didn't love them, because he did. But he had some issues that he was pretty out of control, and he certainly wasn't trying to parent full time whatsoever. So eventually I did leave him when he strangled me in front of my oldest daughter. It was definitely time to make a change. And I think what really hit me as, you know, when you're having the air wrung out of your neck, it's like it could go one of two ways. But I thought, if I leave, if I get out of this, if I survive this, then I'm not just leaving him, I'm leaving abuse. I mean, done and done. And this is the end of this life. And it really was. I did survive, clearly, and I decided to leave. And guess what? I did make a choice to leave that relationship and never go back. So I collected the girls and on we went.
So when I'm listening to you tell me all of this, I'm seeing so many similarities between your childhood and how you grew up and that first marriage. You know, you started to be isolated. He was like, oh, that friend's not good for you. Kind of like your parents would tell you not to have people in your life. And then some of the mental abuse that took place and then turned into physical. So it seemed like it was mirroring, right? And you were also so young and naive. And as you mentioned, you kind of took the first one that came along in a sense. But then I see the pivotal point in your life when you had that first child. You're like, oh, this is somebody that I can love.
Right.
And I can break the cycle.
Right.
And that's the thing. I get asked that as well. I don't have children, but I get asked that, or in conversations when people are survivors of abuse, how is it that switch flipped for you?
Right.
That you were like, no more is this going to happen. And then you just took off with that path. You know, it's so intriguing to me. Do you remember that defining moment? I mean, obviously when he was strangling you too, you were like, oh, I'm out. I'm not going to deal with this.
Right. And Tiffany, I truly believe that it was because my daughter was watching. Mm. She was too. What I didn't understand was kids very much tune into all of the emotional abuse. She was very tuned into that. So she was absorbing that into her sweet little body, you know, just a 2-year-old, feeling like developmentally children. At that age, they believe that what happens in their world is about them and is because of them. So if they're growing up in a great household, how powerful is that? Right. If they're growing up where they see a parent depressed or sad or being treated horribly, how bad is that for them? But when it came to the time, I had minimized emotional abuse, really did, just like a lot of us still do, I think. No bruises, no one's perfect. Forgive and forget, moving forward. When I was strangled in front of her and I heard her screaming, and it was a scream like no other, light bulb. Nobody should have to be exposed to this. I didn't feel like I was good enough to be treated well. At that point, I wasn't there anymore. I didn't think to myself, I deserve better. I didn't think that. I thought this little girl, she's not going to see this happen again. Not on my watch.
It was all for her.
And so later, what I realized was, you know, I had magical thinking. So I thought if you leave abuse of relationships, the abuse ends. Magic. It's all about the person who's being treated poorly making better choices. And that's not true. And so what I didn't realize was as I left him, that really upset his issue of power and control. And so the abuse got worse over time. You know, he would try to break into my new home. He would leave threats when he visited with the kids as they got older. When he had time with them at court-appointed time, he would tell them things like, mommy's going to die. Mommy's going to die and she's going to hell. Mommy doesn't want you anymore.
Wow.
And that all happened for 4 years after I left him until he finally took them out of country and disappeared. So I just didn't have necessarily, at that point, I was working with other domestic abuse victims. I'd finished my college degree finally. And if first you don't succeed, keep it up. So I finished my degree, went to work as a domestic violence advocate, and I loved it. But I was working there when my kids were taken and he left.
And that's interesting. So you were working with people that were going through domestic violence. Here you are dealing with it on your own.
Right.
He flees to another country. It sounds like a European country somewhere.
Yes.
And what's your next step? What do you do?
I could not have been more fortunate. And as somebody who had seriously bad luck, I could not have been more lucky, because I was working in a field that definitely was growing and in understanding of what was happening. So I was working with a bunch of professionals who understood this wasn't about him trying to parent his children. This was about him punishing me for upturning his control. At the same time, Nicole Brown Simpson was murdered, and that is the wife of a famous sports celebrity. And so suddenly all these tapes were playing over and over on the news about domestic abuse, about this woman, because Nicole Brown Simpson had been horribly physically abused on a number of occasions. And as the wife of a celebrity, she still sometimes reached out to law enforcement. And so there, all those 911 tapes were playing. So here I'm from Anchorage, Alaska. The average person didn't have internet at that time. It was like 1994. And thank God for that. We were better people in a lot of ways then. But, really, it was amazing, because people reached out in ways, the news covered it here locally, and people reached out in ways that were things like, I feel horrible for you. What can I do? You know, they replicated the family that I needed. I made $10 an hour. That was a $100,000 problem. Wow. And, I had been the sole supporter of my kids. You know, I was off the food stamps, off public assistance at that point. And here people and my coworkers and friends stood up and said, no. What is it that you need? We're doing this. If you're going to be launching a fight, sign me up. Wow. They didn't say, hey, put it on Facebook, I'll share it. Why don't you throw up a GoFundMe? I can donate $50 and hopefully you'll never talk about this again.
Yeah.
It was a real community. And it was so beautiful. You know, it really was. In Greece, even, you know, I had to go to Greece a couple of different times over the couple of years that my kids were missing. And people used to tell me, hey, nobody's going to help you there. Greeks are all about Greeks. And you know what? I met amazing people that are still part of my life. They were fabulous. What can we do? How can we help you? This is terrible. We've got to get you reunited with your children. So there was some of those amazing sparkle moments where it was like, oh my goodness. At some one point I was arrested in Greece.
Wow.
My former husband said, hey, she's a fugitive. You know, she's taking the kids illegally, blah, blah, blah. They believed him. And I get arrested. But you know what?
Whoa.
9 times out of 10, there were more great things than awful. There really were.
Wow.
And what I didn't understand was when we got home, that wasn't the end. That was the beginning of me coming to terms with what had happened to me. At the same time, they were coming to terms with what happened to them and learning to speak English. Because my little girls were non-English speakers when we first reunited.
Wow.
So the hard part wasn't getting them out of a foreign country. The hard part was coming home, me being a hot mess express after all of this stuff had happened, and then trying to parent them from their pain. It didn't always go well. I added to their scar tissue at times, and so, it was hard.
Well, how were you able to locate them? Get them in your possession. Possession is not the right word, but to get them and take them back here to the States. How were you, like, kind of give us a briefing on that?
It was not elegant at all. So I went by what the State Department told us to do. And if anyone, you know, if you have listeners who are in an abusive relationship, one thing is very important that people understand is there needs to be, whether a person is married or not, they need to have a custody order in place so that if, in fact, some unfortunate or untoward thing occurs and one parent, whether it be a mom or a dad, take the child out of reach, out of state, out of country, whatever, that there's a thing they can look at, the courts can look at and say, okay, there's this custody. That's how I know that this is a violation. So I called 1-800-THE-LOST. That was my first step after calling local police, which was a mess. You know, they didn't know what to do or say. They can't know everything. And it was Anchorage, Alaska back in the day. So I called the 1-800-THE-LOST. That's the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. And I followed their checklist. And that was you get lawyers in the state or the country you believe the kids are at. You get a private investigator. You get an interpreter. You get your legal documents translated. You get them filed in that court. And best wishes. On you go. And so, you know, I had a failed attempt when I went to Greece the first time looking for my kids who I thought had been perfectly identified, and it just all went south. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, then I went back again and my Greek attorneys quit because I hadn't paid them. I didn't have the money. I did not. And so they quit when I got there. There was a big fight between the new investigator and them, not a fist fight, just an argument. And then everyone resolved it. And they were amazing attorneys. They were doing the best they could. This is a very difficult thing. When somebody takes a kid out of state, even, it's impossible. It's so hard to get your kid with different government agencies to agree on what to do, different court jurisdictions, all of that. Think about it in another country, in another culture, very hard. And so, you know, it wasn't perfect, but I definitely did nothing on my own. And I would say and I have a podcast also, but we talk a lot about persistence. And it's really for me, what helped and what I always want to replicate in my life now is solid communication, strong support, and stubborn persistence. But I could do nothing without a lot of help without other people. Nothing. I was no superhero. I wasn't somebody who was like angelic, going to look for my kids. I was never somebody who should be elevated to be put on a pedestal. But I was so fortunate to have amazing support. And without it, they'd still be there.
Wow. How long did the process take then from the time that they were taken from you to the time you were able to bring them home with you?
I found out they were missing on March 15th, but their dad had an opportunity to see them. You know, he exercised his opportunity on March 13th in 1994, but it wasn't until I went to pick them up that 1994, 2 days later, March 15th, that I realized, oh, he's not coming back. He's not, mm-hmm. You're not here. So that started it. And then by the time I ever saw the girls, I never heard from them ever. A lot of abductors will call the parent they've left behind to have the kid talk to the parent. And to, you know, maybe sometimes at least let them talk to the kids. Sometimes it's torture them, make them feel worse. Wow. But I never got a call. So it was deep March of 1996 when I first laid eyes on my children. And we couldn't leave the country for several weeks yet. And so we got home in May of 1996. May 24th, wow. 1996. And that was a long time. Those were some really precious years in a child's life. But it wasn't just being kidnapped. By all means, that is a horrible thing. You take a kid from their school, from their friends, from their routines, their pets, their toys, their mom, or their dad, whatever. All of that's gone. Add on the culture piece, their language. And they end up in a foreign place. And then he took off again, apparently. He dropped them off in Greece and he left. He wasn't doing it to be with them. I go back and I reunite with them. And it wasn't easy. It's just a gross story that I won't bring up. But when we're leaving, no matter if it's the court blesses you or the court doesn't bless you, whatever it is, you're taking that kid again away from what? You're taking them away from their friends, their school, their toys, their parent, their routine, and again, culture, language, food. It was devastating. Wow. And I did not appreciate how devastating that was. I felt like this is where my mom, you know, lives inside me. We came home and I'm like, aren't you grateful to be back? I didn't say it like that, but that's how I felt. Look, we got you everything. You have toys. You have your own bedrooms now. You have this, you have that. Aren't you grateful? Isn't that great? Let's just talk about how great it is. Not appreciating how incredibly devastating this was for them.
Wow. So when you take them back and they're living with you, sorry, I'm asking all these questions about it. So intriguing. I just need to read the book, really, is what I need to do. But were they so accepting of you or were they very cold? I mean, there was a language barrier, which I want to say, did you know the language at all?
Not well enough. Not well enough. I tried to study up on it and I have this wonderful, amazing friend named Poppy, who is Greek. And she was helping me learn the language when I got there on the first trip. She would stay up at night after her long day as a lawyer. She wasn't my lawyer, but she would come home from her law practice and kick off her slippers and say, and here she had me to stay with her. This is a woman who didn't know me at first and said, stay at my house. Don't spend money on a hotel. Stay with me. Then she would get out her books and say, okay, here's a sticky note with the English word and the Greek word. Say it. Say it again. Say it again. So I knew just enough to be dangerous. And so what I tried to learn when I was doing things better, you know, when I was my better self, when we first met up, the kids, first of all, one of my children looked at me like I was a ghost. And then the little one thought I was, because after all, she had been told at one point that I was dead.
Oh, wow.
So it was so exciting. I have a picture actually in this very room of our first day of reuniting. It was exciting for me. It was terrifying for them. And they had to, you know, I couldn't just take them and run. At that point, we had pending legal actions. So they knew they would have to pay they would pay dearly with their dad if they were kind to me. And so, you know, at first they were very standoffish, cold, all of that. And then I was allowed to come back and see them the next day at school. Teachers, it's so funny because the teachers could not stand my former husband. And this is in Greece. And they said to me, you know, a couple of the teachers who spoke enough English, this is not good. Your kids are hardly ever coming to school. They're dressed horribly. They speak poorly. Take them and run if you get the opportunity. And so it really made my mind up that this has, you know, I've definitely got to go home with them. There's no question. Wow. So the kids warmed up to me over time and I hired an interpreter, kind of like Poppy, but I hired somebody who was Scottish who spoke fluent Greek and she would come to our hotel. There was a time where I was granted temporary custody while we're waiting for the stuff all the court hearings to wrap up. And this, so they started picking up language and they were just adorable. But they, you know, so they warmed up to me, but then they would say really like just whatever came to their mind was unfiltered, you know, and they're speaking in their new English. And some of it was about their dad and some of it wasn't, you know, and it was a precious time and very stressful. And then eventually, you know, eventually they warmed up, but there was, especially from my youngest, there was a lot of anger toward me. And I think she felt so sympathetic to him. And, you know, it wasn't easy. And they felt conflicted losing all those things again. And by the way, he's got an amazing family. Amazing. Like he's definitely the black sheep in his family. They're very kind and they had no hand in the abduction. But one of my nieces by marriage, who's Greek, told me years later, we were children. He shows up with these, we didn't even know he had a second daughter. Because that was a stigma for a Greek man in his mind to have a second daughter. He needed a son. Hmm. He said, we didn't even know he had a second daughter. He shows up out of nowhere, drops the kids off, and takes off. What are we supposed to do? Of course we took care of the kids. We were teenagers, you know, like 14, 15, you know, what should we do? And I wasn't blaming them anyway. But kids cannot fix that mess. Right. But he does have wonderful family. And he just was not. In my opinion.
So what did you do then to prevent them from repeating the cycle of abuse in their lives?
You mean the efforts that I made?
Yes.
That we should all make, even if we have a history of family abuse or not. Because I think, to be honest with you, Tiffany, I think abuse is so common in relationships that even if I'd had a wonderful marriage, I would still need to have very unfiltered conversations with my kids as they grew up about healthy relationships and not healthy relationships. One thing that was good and bad was I never did keep secrets. And so as soon as we came home, we all went to therapy, our different therapists. We did, you know, I did group counseling, all of those different things. But I talked to my kids. Of course, I was still working at the domestic violence agency that I love. But, you know, we talked about what happened. We talked about how I ended up in that relationship. We talked about signs of an abusive relationship and too much control. And the importance of, A, not thinking just because you're female means you're going to have kids or you have to get married. I mean, I always wanted them to know they have value whether you choose to be with someone, whether you don't, no matter who your partner is, they must respect and love you. And they want you to be your better self. And if you have good friendships, they celebrate those. If you have hobbies or you have aspirations, they are your best cheerleader. They love you and they know you're not perfect, but they are there and they're a safe person. So we had those conversations. Did it take root and mean that nobody experienced any kind of abuse in their relationships? Not at all. But that's what I did. Those are the conversations we had. And the conversation that I have with everyone that I work with now is like, don't forget, there's never shame in asking for support. Don't expect your family and friends to listen to, not to be mean, but your family and friends don't want to hear about your abusive relationship all day long as you're in it and figuring out what to do. They just don't. They're not qualified to help you suss through stuff. But not only that, it's like the voodoo doll. Like you are stabbing them with a pin when you talk about all these awful things to, and then you go back in that relationship as you're making decisions. It's personal. They cannot make it impersonal, and it's not fair to expect that. Right. So don't hesitate to get the support you need that isn't family or friends. And I'm not saying keep your abuse secret from family and friends. I'm just saying don't use them as the constant 911 because they're not dispatchers.
So there's definitely people who are going to be listening to this episode that are going through abuse in their life right now. And they might be that mom that's being abused by the husband, or the husband being abused by the wife, vice versa. What is your biggest piece of advice, given your journey, that you can tell them? I know you just said, you know, maybe not reaching out to friends and family, reaching out to the right people. What advice do you have as a takeaway for them?
And I love that you said that. And definitely, I'm not suggesting anyone keep secrets from their friends and families, right, but just not using them as their only source of support. I don't want people to feel isolated. And that would be my biggest, biggest takeaway is resist isolation and reach out for support. And when you reach out for not just, I don't mean go to a therapist and expect that that's going to be the only help, but if you're in an abusive relationship, seek experts who are experts, whether it's a domestic violence agency, whatever, seek experts who are supposed to by nature. One thing I loved about that job is if they're doing their job well, it's a domestic violence advocate. They're not telling you, you need to go or you need to stay. They're helping you safety plan because there needs to be a safety plan in place. They're helping you see patterns. They're giving you access to other people in the form of group support. Of course, we've just come through a very isolating time with COVID, mm-hmm. and not all of us are through it yet. So some of those services aren't in person, and that's crushing. But definitely, definitely offering access to other people who have and who are going through the same issue, it's invaluable. There is no substitute for what that can bring a person that to just learn about the patterns and signs. A good abuse advocate will say, well, why do you think that person does this to you? What do you think that person gains from keeping you from your family or keeping you from your job? Or do you know what I'm saying? What do you think that they're doing this for? They're helping you think through what are the reasons this is happening? And not encouraging, I would also say, I don't encourage people to leave one bad situation and go to the first hand like I did and grab onto it and make one person your sole source of support, whether that's a female friend or whether it's a new partner, especially a new partner, because I have worked with a lot of women who grab onto that next hand who doesn't physically abuse them and thinks everything is perfect for a while, only to years later realize I'm still being controlled, demeaned, and I just changed the name. And so, you know, definitely getting, coming to a place where she feels her own strength is really critical, and feeling like she could do fine on her own. Would it be easy or fun? No, but that she gets that confidence that she can do whatever she needs to do. I mean, relationships shouldn't be based solely on our weaknesses, you know, and vulnerabilities. It should be elevating our strengths.
I think that's very common. What you said is just, and I know this from my upbringing with my mother always went from one man to the next, Like she wouldn't leave a situation until she had another situation lined up, but it was just abuse in another form.
Right.
And I think a lot of women go through that, and that's very common. They don't feel they can stand on their own 2 feet. So, sorry, my alarm is going off. So I think, you know, that's really crucial to understand that you can do this. Like, you don't have to have a man in your life. And I'm not like being a feminist here.
Right, right, right. I mean, not that there's anything wrong with that, but yeah, it's not even about male or female. It's that we want to feel whole inside.
Right.
And there's nothing wrong with feeling whole inside. But, and I also want to pay homage to our mom's generations too, because my mom married a lot also, but what could they do? I mean, this was a different, a lot of times people say, well, the good old days and, oh, families were together and this and that. Boy, they didn't have a lot of choices,
right.
You know, so really men were their currency because they didn't have the access to the education and the jobs. And I do feel, even though a lot of us suffered for it, I do feel bad for them, but we're not there anymore. And hope, you know, hopefully people understand it's important to learn how to support ourselves and to get that support, emotional support from people. And to, when Valentine's Day comes and you're single, go get yourself some chocolates and have a celebration. You don't, it's okay. It's okay. It's not ideal all the time, but it's all right if that's the circumstance.
Right. So we're running out of time here, but there's a few other things I want to discuss. One thing I'm really intrigued by, and I mentioned this in the beginning, is you took on a position of being a child abuse investigator.
Yes.
How long did you do that for, and how did it impact your life given your childhood?
You know, I think that was such a great perspective. And, you know, the national average for being a child abuse investigator, who, you know, people treat as though they're the scum of the earth and the reason why abuse exists is social workers. And that's absolutely not true. They are intervening in what is going on or making an effort to. But the national average for that horrifying job is 18 months. And that is exactly how long I stayed. Before, and I love my memories there. I mean, I do. It's interesting because I had some of the same families who were from the abuse center who ended up being in the child protective system. Sometimes the abuser was the mom. Sometimes the abuser was the dad. And then they followed me to juvenile probation. So some of them, I feel like I belong in their baby albums. But, you know, the one neat thing about that work, outside of honoring amazing strength of children and their resilience just to survive, is it made me understand my life was easy compared to what I saw. It was a walk in the park. Same with the kids in juvenile probation. They didn't end up in a horrible situation. Typically, this is not always true. There are a minority of people who absolutely seem to have a strong childhood and for various reasons get in legal troubles. But the majority of what I saw were people that I just could not imagine 2 days in their shoes. And it gave me that perspective of, yes, I had gone through a lot of things. Was it triggering at times? Sure. When I saw siblings being torn apart, that was the trigger. But it was a great feeling too, because I also understood a whole lot of layers underneath the surface. I understood from my own upbringing that when a mom accidentally finds out that her new beau is sexually abusing maybe her child, that she will act protective at first, and that lasts about 72 hours. You know, come back, social worker, to the house and find out what's really happening, because the child is going to be blamed for seducing this person. So, you know, that's the kind of stuff that it really was helpful in some ways. But 18 months later, I had a friend who hadn't seen me in a while, and he said, "You look horrible. You have aged 10 years. Whatever you're doing, stop." And it's horrible. It's a horrible work. But I met some amazing kids and some amazing families, some families who had opportunities to change and did. You know, there's always hope when you have some resources, when you have that persistence, and when people get support, if they have the opportunity to change, it doesn't happen all the time, but when they do, it's worth celebrating.
Wow. I applaud you for the work you did. Seriously, I can't imagine.
Thank you.
I think when I was little, I used to always want to be a social worker. And now I also have a nonprofit for the abused that I started back in high school that's still running today.
Love that.
Even just seeing, I basically what I'm trying to say is I've never been in your line of work, but just seeing what I've seen through the nonprofit, it's just like, wow, my story is so insignificant compared to what is out there. And, you know, you mentioned in our conversation, you know, when you were a child, abuse was something that people swept under the rug. Now we're in a society that it's brought to the forefront and there's way more resources, and it's not like this, you know, it's politically incorrect to talk about it or whatever the case may be. So, you know, we've come a long way. We really have.
And if it weren't for our mom's generations and all the things they'd went through, then we wouldn't be here. And I always want to think about that. When I think about my mom, I think, you know, I have to remember that there was a different context, and I am grateful that we're not there. And I don't ever want us to go back to that.
Yeah, amen to that. So I want to ask you real quick before we go into 20 questions, in this memoir that you wrote, what inspired you to write it, and what's your hope for people that read it?
Well, I start, and Tiffany, I was going to tell you this. I start the memoir. I went to a writer's conference once. Now, mind you, I was a journalism major when I, you know, I got a graduate degree in psychology eventually, but I was a journalism major. I always loved the idea of writing. I have always thought it's kind of saved me thinking about life as your story. Every story is a beginning, a middle, and an end. So no matter what was happening, I knew it wouldn't be forever. So I like the idea of writing. I had so many amazing memories and new friendships from the whole Greek tragedy. But when I went to work in juvenile probation, I started being a trainer for trauma-informed care and the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study. I would definitely, if you put that in show notes, ACEs, you know, with this Center for Disease Control, the government has a neat link on getting your ACE score. But I just thought, let's start this book from where we are today. And so we start out reassuring the reader that I got my kids back. And we start in a current day snippet of me giving a training at trauma-informed care when my daughter reached out to me right in the middle of the training. And I knew that people, I wanted to greenlight people to at least look at their own ACE score, to look at the fact that no matter what we've gone through, there is a lot of hope still. Yes, our childhood brain is impacted by what happens in the home negatively sometimes, depending on our household. Sometimes we have great households, but it's not over until we're over. We can rewire the brain, and there's lots of hope. And so I really wanted to tell and honor the story because it was a beautiful story about how people rallied to support. They were going to gain nothing by helping me. They gained nothing. They gave everything, and it gave my children a life they wouldn't have had. They're in their 30s now, and you know, they're amazing humans. They both finished college. Neither have married. I don't think I set an example that said they said to themselves, "Let's try that." But I wanted people to understand that there's lots of hope.
Oh, that's wonderful. And I love what you're doing. So let's figure this out. How can people buy your book? First of all, let's start there.
Well, and thanks for asking. It is available wherever books are sold, but you'd have to order it. So if you love your independent bookstore, feel free to order it there. It's on Audible. It's on other formats and audio format now as well. A lot of people who listen to podcasts love their audiobooks, and so do I. So they can do that. It's certainly on the online retailers such as Barnes & Noble and Amazon and all the things, but it can be ordered locally.
And once again, the name of that book is called Pieces of Me, Rescuing My Kidnapped Daughters. So if you guys want to check that book out, I know I want to read it. You can, you know, she kind of told you guys where to find that. You said you also are a podcaster. What's your podcast?
And you know, I love the term persistence. And so I call it Persistence U. U as in university. It's the letter. Persistence U with Lizbeth. And it's a baby podcast. I mean, we're coming up on 20 episodes. And my courses that I teach also are under Persistence U. But I want people to feel that they're a part of a community that I was lucky enough to be a part of. And it's not about privilege. It's not about good luck or having money. It largely is developing strong community and stubborn persistence. And so that's, you know, in the podcast, I tell people's story. It's 30 minutes of persistence.
Well, we'll be sure to put the link to your podcast on there as well.
Thank you.
Anything else? Do you have a website? How can we find you on social media? Give us that information.
Yes, I'm at lameredith.com. And so the letter L, the letter A, Meredith, my last name, .com. So you could find stuff there. And I'm on Facebook author page, certainly. And I've got, you know, Twitter and Instagram that I never look at. And I'm at LinkedIn and, you know, all the normal stuff. So thanks for asking. It's fun to hear from people. And
absolutely.
I love talking to you, Tiffany. Thank you for what you're doing is so important.
Thank you. That means a lot to me. It really does. And I'm glad that you came on to speak loud about what you know about abuse and your journey and your biggest takeaways. Speaking of which, what do you hope the audience will take away from what we've talked about here today?
That there is always, always hope for a better future.
Love that. Anything else you want to add?
That's pretty much it, I think. I'm kind of bracing myself for this question business.
Oh, it's going to be fun. Okay. So without further ado, we'll get into the 20 questions. So it's just kind of a lighthearted thing I do at the end here because we've talked about some pretty heavy stuff. So if you would, pick a number between 1 and 20.
8.
Ooh, this one's a good one.
Uh-oh.
Where's the strangest place you've ever gone potty?
Oh.
Excuse me.
Gosh. I am sorry to bore you, but I think it's just been camping probably in the woods.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm asking you a different question then.
Sorry.
No, it's good. It's good. Man, let me see.
Okay. Can I change that?
Yep.
Okay. I went to Morocco. I started traveling by myself on a shoestring budget when my kids were grown. So I tried to hit all the continents, trying to hit them all before I'm 60, which is coming up. So better hurry. But I went to Morocco one time that wasn't alone. And it was just a very different toilet. It was, for me, we were far, far, far out toward the desert. And there weren't many obvious places to go. Everyone was covered, you know, they had their coverings and we were in very, very, very rural territory. I had to go to the bathroom. So this restaurant pointed me in a direction. It was just a little hole and a garden hose. And there was no nothing. It was a hole in a garden hose. So I guess it was there.
Okay, we'll accept that. When I
thank
say
you.
Real, I mean, it's me and the mouse in my pocket, I guess. I don't know. It's just me. Anyways, no, I just try to do something a little lighthearted at the end there, and I appreciate you sharing that. But what I want to say is that you are a light, and keep shining your light, and keep being a light worker, helping others, you know, find the light in darkness. I know your book is impacting so many. Your story is impacting so many. I feel so honored that our paths have crossed. And
you
guys go support Lizbeth in what she's doing. We'll put all that information in the show notes. So you literally just have to click on it. We'll take you to all the stuff you need to see. And as always, be the change you wish to see in this world. Have a great day.
Thank you for listening to Speak Loud. If this message resonated with you, please feel free to share it with anyone you feel could use the support. To find out more information about Share, our movement, and to join the cause, please visit sharethemovement.org. Until next time.